that's Segundo here, and I'm feeling particularly concerned about what I might be telling you in these introductions. You see, my attorney, a man who I commissioned based on his compelling late-night television commercial, insists that I might be liable in revealing some of my personal foibles to you on air. He insists that I need to pay him more money to investigate what I just as soon untell everything I've confessed to you over the last 98 shows. So, the incident involving two cocktail waitresses and a gallon of sour cream in 1997 never happened. Last year's trip with Jorge to the desert, you didn't hear it from me. The surgical operation I had to enhance an anatomical appendage, what are you talking about? Wait a minute, I don't think I told you about that last one, but, that assumes that it's true. Okay, it can't really be true because I'm untelling it. I'm untelling it. Good gravy and garlic. I give up, but I do untell everything.
So I am here with Tayari Jones, who is the author of The Untelling. Tayari, how are you doing today?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you very much.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you, it's an obvious question, but Arya, the protagonist of your book, what are the similarities and the differences between you and Arya? Because they both come from Atlanta, there's a lot of, you know...
Well, you know, there are a lot of people from Atlanta.
That's true.
It's really funny because my name, Tayari, sounds almost like it, like someone called me Tayaria.
I know, I was about to say that too.
And I didn't even notice it, but I first started thinking about it because about the names. I come from a family where our parents named the hell out of us. I mean, my older brother is named Patrice Lumumba Jones.
Wow.
So I really got that fun idea to start off with a family where their parents put all their ambition for their children into the names.
Gotcha.
So she and I have that in common. She's a graduate of Spelman College, where I also went to school. And I taught adult literacy for a while, like she did. So I drew from those experiences. And I know the area I know that area of Atlanta very well. So it was kind of fun to set the story on a backdrop of a place that I know very well that I think is really underrepresented. Like my Atlanta is really different than, say, Tom Wolfe's Atlanta.
Gotcha. Well, is Atlanta something of a muse for you? Because we've had two books so far and they're both involving Atlanta.
Atlanta is kind of a world for me, really. When I imagine stories, they're set in Atlanta. And I like to write a story in a city, in a place where I really know. When I started writing The Untelling, I tried to set it in Phoenix, because that's where I was living when I started writing it. But I didn't know in Phoenix, if I set something, say, on Baseline Road, I would not know what was on Baseline before the condos. And I feel like if you don't know that, then you don't know enough to write the story. And so Atlanta is a place that I've known through its changes. So when I'm somewhere in Atlanta, I'm really there.
Gotcha. Now, I wanted to actually ask you about The Untelling, and specifically the style. Because to me, it was both sort of conversational and also literary. I noticed that you had this tendency in the book to kind of attach metaphors often as clauses near the end of a sentence, such as the moment where the car drives over gravel and then the gravel springs up like popcorn. I was wondering if you can possibly talk about the relationship between the conversational versus these metaphors like that.
Well, one thing I think is that a lot of times, I teach writing, and my students are always saying, how do you get the metaphors in there? And I tell them that people use metaphors in conversation all the time. People who don't know what metaphors are use metaphors all the time. It's just a way that you make language more vivid, more comfortable when you're talking. The gravel does jump like popcorn. And I try to use popcorn as something that a person like Arya or a person reading the book knows exactly what that looks like. I think that's really the key, is that you want your metaphor to be something that maybe, like, a person may not have thought of likening gravel to popcorn, but when you say it, the reader knows exactly what you mean instantly. I hate it when I see a metaphor and I have to sit there and say, now what would that be like? And then get it.
So for you, a metaphor must be one of these sorts of situations where it's a universally identifiable sort of thing in order to actually sort of win the reader over and not have the metaphor sort of stick out like kind of a sore thumb.
Yeah, I like it just to make it more clear. That's what I think it is. When you write fiction, you're trying to make your lie more believable, the lie of the story more believable. And one way you do it is you put in metaphor, you put in figurative language to make to convey, to make it more vivid. It's not about doing literary somersaults or what my teacher Ron Carlson used to call virtuosity on the high wire. Yeah. You know, look at me, look at me. No, it's not look at me, it's look at this story is what you want to do.
You've reported in your blog and various other places that you write a good deal of pages and then you toss a good deal of them out. And I'm wondering, why not just outline a book? Or do you outline a book and then these become these mammoth sorts of situations?
I don't outline.
It'd save a lot of time, though, you know?
I don't know if you would save time. I don't know. I don't. It's just not interesting to me. I like to discover as I write. Writing for me is... it's epistemological. It's how I learn the story. I learn the story by writing the story. I also think that if I were to outline it, I would know where the story was going, and so would the reader. And that's no fun. And so, yeah, I waste a lot of pages, but that's just the way it is. I mean, the point is to get the best book I can get, and I save time. But you know what? It's not like I'm not billing anyone by the hour. Like, the time, it doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay, so time is not an issue of you, but then you're dealing with, like, perhaps a publisher is going to say, Tiare, you must do one book a year in order to, you know, stay in the public consciousness. But a lot of authors have that problem.
Well, people do say that, but no one really says it to me that much. And they can say what they want to say. At the end of the day, you want the best book you can have. And if that's one reason why I'm a big proponent of keeping the day job, in that if I don't produce a book a year or whatever, it's not like I'm not going to eat. I don't have that bread and butter issues motivating me. I think I'll always keep my day job for that very reason.
Gotcha. Well, going back to this sort of dichotomy I was suggesting and the gray areas that lie beneath the sort of conversational versus the literary spectrum, when do you decide when something should be, I guess, more presented in a direct kind of conversational manner? And when do you decide that something really sort of needs a metaphor?
It just depends on how vivid it is. And if, like, let's say you've written a couple, three pages, and you haven't had anything to really pop yet, then you're going to lose some of your readers. So often when I go back, I sometimes add layers of description. Or sometimes I see things, like, for example, I was looking in a Bible, and I noticed how thin the pages were, and I was like, wow, thin as Bible paper. I love that. And I just kept it in my mind, and I ended up using it for something later. So that also happens. I pick up metaphors just in life, or I hear people talking, and I just make a note, and I might use it later.
So you have sort of a repository of metaphors then, essentially.
I just like to pay attention, that's what I would say.
Okay. I wanted to actually ask you about the mother character in this book and how she constantly asks, is this what Dr. King died for? I was wondering how this came about, because it seems to me that, you know, Arya isn't just weighed down by this family issue about what to reveal to her family without revealing the actual plot of the book, but it also seems that it could be vaguely sort of metaphorical about, like, you know, well, where does she stand in relation to sort of Dr. King's triumphs?
I would say almost everything I write, Dr. King keeps coming back. I'm from Atlanta. That's Dr. King's hometown.
I was going to remark upon that.
And it's always on my mind. It's part of the city, is that this is where Dr. King was from. Are you living up to that? I think it's a generational burden that I was born in 1970. Dr. King died in 1968. Yeah. And the big question is, yes, are you... So I'm the generation of African Americans that have been born into the benefits of civil rights. So it's like, okay, now what are you going to do with it? And that's always just yapping at our heels. And I think it's a real generational thing. It's a generational thing that isn't spoken about that much. And that's one reason why, too, I was kind of fooling around in the introduction, in the, what is it called?
Prologue?
The prologue, yeah. Thank you. The prologue, when they run into that magnolia tree, and that, you know, it's a southern thing. And I said, you know, for me, I'm going to have a deadly magnolia. But it's, too, the burden of place, of the South, of time, of generation, all of that is what Arya is wading her way through.
Gotcha. So is there sort of an overarching metaphor, would you say, in terms of, like, pre and post Dr. King? Or
is it a metaphor? Is it a condition? I don't know what it is, but it's something that I think about all the time. And, like, when Arya is in college and she sees that Spelman, where she went to school, this is where Dr. King laid in state, right on the stage where she's sitting. I mean, I had those moments myself all the time when I was coming up. You just stumble across these moments in history. And even as a young person, I knew, okay, people died for you. What are you doing? So I don't know if it's an overarching metaphor, but it's almost like, I don't know if I would say it's a malaise. I don't know what I would say it is, but it is ribbon through the book.
Well, to me, it struck me as a metaphor because, for example, the neighborhood of West End, it's just on the cusp of gentrification in the sense that it's kind of this bubble that's sort of still retains some kind of integrity to some degree, even though at the same time, well, on the flip side, you've got these, you know, these crack addicts, you've got these people stealing things and breaking into homes and the like. And I'm wondering if the neighborhood was sort of a kind of commentary on, I guess integrity to some degree in relation to this overarching metaphor or condition or what have you.
I think that the neighborhood really, I love that neighborhood because it really is a cross section of Atlanta. It's because those neighborhoods that are half gentrified.
Yeah.
It's the one moment when you have everyone living on the same block. I mean, we make a lot of noise about racial segregation in this country, but it's class segregation, I think, that's the most stubborn.
Oh, absolutely.
And so in these half-gentrified neighborhoods, you have homeowners and squatters living on the same block. And I do think that it's just a section, a very representative section of what Atlanta is. And I also think that the urban South in many ways is where the rubber hits the road for issues for the whole country. So I feel like a whole nation is in the 6 or 7 blocks of West End, and that's why I chose to put it there. So it is representative, I guess, or would it be metonymous?
I suppose so.
There you go. Yeah.
Lay out the modifier of your choice. Oh yeah, actually, I wanted to actually ask you about Arya's naivety in the sense that she's 25, and when the plot development midway through the book, actually the doctor announces the news, it struck me that she just didn't catch on and that she was almost like Keisha, the teenager. And I wanted to actually ask you if this was sort of intentional, that you wanted to keep her sort of, I guess, in this sort of almost teenage mindset at times, despite the fact that she's apparently intelligent, despite the fact that she's capable of, you know, figuring out and perceiving a lot of things, but with herself and with this development, she can't.
A lot of women, I think, can be really regressive in when it comes to matters of romance, marriage, etc. You know, people always say an intelligent woman or an educated woman, but it's kind of like these ideas and aspirations. She has such ambitions to be married and to be a mother and to have her life legitimized in that way. And roadblocks to that, she's never considered them. She's just never considered this was not her birthright. She will marry and she will have children and she will have a new family. This is the thing that is, she feels it's like promise to every woman is inalienable. And so I think it does just kind of throw her off, and she's in that, and she's so hopeful. I mean, I do think that a kind of hear no evil, see no evilness has allowed her to be able to function in her life even. So I think that's kind of how, and Keisha, on the other hand, has just had a completely different experience. One thing that I was fooling around with in this book is the question of privilege and where people are on various social hierarchies and how naivete is a privilege.
So naivete is sort of like, I guess, the kickstart towards personal identity, would you say, for...
I think that she's naive, but then she's less naive than her roommate or everyone has different levels. I think everyone in this book has a... Everyone in the book has a sense of entitlement. Even the crack addict has a sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
Like, no one thinks they're the lowest of the low, and no one believes himself to be hopeless. So I think that everyone has a little, you call it naivete, I might say optimism, or...
purity, perhaps.
Yeah, everyone does. Everyone does in the book. I love the way that nobody has a good grip on where they are in the world.
So going back to this issue of purity and naivety... So this is kind of reflective of a certain kind of level of entitlement. Is this your kind of way of pinpointing American identity here? Or?
Well, you do definitely entitlement, and oh my goodness, are we not a oblivious entitled culture? Yes,
yeah.
I mean, it's a luxury not to see the horrible thing that's coming around the corner.
Sure.
It's a luxury not to believe that there's a curveball coming at your head.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that is a way of that all the people, it is a way of, the way you anticipate disaster is a function of your identity.
So when you were devising this character, did this ideology kind of creep up through the course of this level of invention of turning out pages or?
Yeah, it all comes out when I work on it. Like, I don't say, okay, I'm going to write a character and I'm thinking that everyone in the book, I kind of write what I believe this is true. And once it's over, I analyze it and think about, okay, I've written this. Now, what am I really saying? What are the ideological underpinnings of the book? But I don't think about it in the process. I try to just tell the truth, the story. I like the characters to be the way I believe they would be if they were walking down the street. I try to write characters that I feel like live in the world, not live in a book. You know, sometimes you read a book and the people seem like they live in a book. Like, you can't imagine people in the world.
So thematics are something that kind of originates as a matter of course then, basically.
It does, yes. And then once it's done and I start tweaking it, I sometimes sharpen things. Like, if I see a theme coming, I say, oh, I see this is coming around a lot, I'll ramp it up. But when I'm just doing the initial creation, I'm just telling a story.
So it's kind of like a continuous first draft kind of situation for you.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I used to, I dropped out of a couple of PhD programs in literature, so I do have some background in theory and criticism in that way, and I do find myself after the draft, after the first draft is done, applying that kind of reading to it.
The word processing machine seemed to be sort of a slightly kind of outmoded form of technology that I found quite interesting. I'm wondering, why did you choose that instead of, you know, say, like a emerging computer or something like that? It seemed a very specific thing to settle upon, almost like an old word star. So.
Yeah, it's the 80s. That, do you remember them? They look kind of like typewriters.
Yeah.
You could see about four or five lines of text. Actually, I drew autobiographically there. I had this word processing machine when I was in college, and I saved all my money, and I worked a telemarketing job to pay for it because I thought it would make me a better writer. I thought if I had this thing, and no one supported me in getting it. And I remember that machine as the first time that I had really committed myself, my resources, my labor, my money into trying to be a writer. And so I used it there because it just resonates with me because of that. And so I love that she was saving for it. And it cost like $500, right? It was like really expensive.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
It's like $1,000 now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to actually ask you about an essay you wrote at Mods on Mods site,
yes,
where you noted that The Untelling had been categorized into the African-American category, and you compared yourself to a pardoned Thanksgiving turkey.
Yes, now, which I borrowed from Arundhati Roy. Yeah,
yes, exactly. But at the same time, The Untelling has made its way into Target. In my experiences of going into like Target Greatland is that they just have a book section.
They do.
So what do you think accounts for this, you know, Jim Crow treatment? I mean, and why do you think some bookstores do this and some don't?
See, my position on this is no one ever believes my position on this. I think, actually, as strange as it's going to sound, the bookstores that tend to have the African-American section,
yeah,
tend to carry more African-American titles than bookstores that don't have these sections.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, there's a bookstore in D.C., Kramer Books. They, you know, they pride themselves on shelving everything together. And they have hardly any books by people of color there.
Yeah.
And with no section, there's no way of keeping them honest. They don't know what they have.
Yeah.
And though they can feel very progressive about their shelving, my book isn't in there.
Yeah.
But if I go to a store that has an African-American section, my book is always in that store. Now, but the thing about it is that for me, too, is that without the African-American section, most African-American authors would not sell any books. I mean, this is like really the sad truth is that the people who read books by African-American authors usually are looking for a book by an African-American author.
Yeah.
So if that section wasn't available, those readers who are a big proportion of our readership couldn't find our books. For it to be shelved in with everything else, and then you wouldn't sell any books. I mean, it's very clear that when your publisher wants to sell your book to a mixed audience, they won't put any black people on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they won't, and it's kind of because they know this. I don't know, it's just very distressing for me. That is actually something that really upsets me a lot. I feel like it makes it so hard to make it as a writer if you're black.
It's actually this description of, you know, African-American section themed bookstores having more African-American titles. It's true also for mystery and science fiction. I mean, I feel the same way you do, that there should just be a fiction section with mystery, science fiction, African-American, you name it. It should just be there.
But if it's there, I'm telling you, I think that's a nice idea if we lived in a different kind of world. I mean, we kind of like to pin it on the bookstores for dividing people, but the bookstores have done it because that's the way that they increase the sales total. The bookstores sell more books if they have the sections away. So we can have this kind of push for our national identity and shelve them any kind of way. But honestly, I mean, I am always dismayed when I go to friends' house and look at their bookshelves and see that mostly, particularly if the person whose house it is not African American, the only African American authors they have on there are like crazy famous.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like you have the bar to get on someone's radar. It's so high. Like, when you hear about people complaining about the African-American section in the bookstore, you notice they're always looking for someone. They're like, I was looking for Toni Morrison, and they told me she was in the African-American section. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you have been shopping in this bookstore for 20 years, and you never, ever, ever notice that the so-called literature section is all white. You never notice it. It's because you don't care. Until you got a wild hair to read Toni Morrison, and now you're all outraged because you have to walk, you know, 10 paces this way to get to the section. I'm just so not convinced by this outrage. I mean, the person never noticed.
Sure. You also wrote an essay at Scott's site, which touches upon this issue, where you described two different readings you did in two different areas and how you witnessed and observed segregation to some degree there as well. I mean, there's got to be one of your readings has had to have some sort of, like, you know, common audience where everyone has kind of just come irrespective of, you know.
Have you ever been to a reading that was like that?
Very few.
Exactly. I mean, it's just, I mean, we are such a segregated nation. And this is back to this whole thing about the shelving. This is why I think that the nation has to change before the shelving. That's what I'm thinking. The nation has to change before the shelving. When I do a store, I normally go, like when I went to San Francisco last summer, I did Marcus Books in Oakland. Huge crowd. I would say 97% African American. And that's probably undercutting. And then I did a clean, well-lighted place for books, and nearly everyone was white, and maybe two black people, one of whom I knew already, so which isn't really the same, in the same area. And people from San Francisco went to Oakland. Black people I knew from San Francisco went to the Oakland reading, you know, rather than the one that's more convenient to their home.
Wow.
So I do think that, no, I think it's, I mean, I think the segregation is huge. And I think that we really have to look at, as a nation, what we're reading, why we're reading what we're reading. And I don't think it's right to, it's like a lot of pressure is put on the writer. Well, what have you done to get your book out to different places? And I just can't imagine someone, you know, I never hear white authors being asked, so what are you doing to get your book out to the black people?
Yeah.
You know, I never hear it.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, you could also argue that Edward Jones is a case of someone who has achieved literary respectability.
I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying the bar is crazy.
Do you think you have two strikes against you because you're African-American and a woman?
I don't know if I'm going to call them strikes.
I don't want to call them strikes. Strikes in the eyes of someone who is, you know, going to categorize you.
Well, I would say, but, you know, the whole thing with this discussion that makes me a little uneasy is that my African-American female readership has been just lovely to me.
Sure.
Just the support has been overwhelming. And sometimes I feel like I don't want to sound like I'm saying that they are not taking care of me, like their chopped liver, and what I really want is this group of people that's not interested in reading my book.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to make sure I say just how nurturing my African-American female readership, the book clubs, the people who read my blog. I mean, they've been fantastic to me. But that said, I do think I often run across people, like, on planes. They say, oh, you're a writer. I say, yes. And it may be a man. And sometimes men will say to you, you know, I don't like books by women. Straight face, they'll say it.
Wow.
And then what do you say? I mean, you can't get in a fight on a plane, but, I mean, so I am aware of that, and I am aware that certain subjects are considered more important than others.
Yeah.
And,
Well, it's the case, like, for example, A.M. Holmes can write a book about some really disturbing sort of incident, and then it becomes this big sort of, I mean, she's a great writer, but then it becomes this huge kind of sort of thing because maybe she's a woman, whereas, you know, David Foster Wallace can write a disturbing story, like The Girl with Curious Hair, and no one will think twice about it.
I mean, the culture is, as, you know, Bell Hooks would say, what's that great thing? What did she say? It's a white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. I mean, it is. And it is, these things are true, and it's going to affect the way that people who are marginalized in any way try to negotiate the artistic marketplace.
Yeah.
I mean, I try not to think too much about it, because at the end of the day, I have to write the best book I can write for the reasons. You know, Richard Powers said to me one time, I'm going to misquote him, but the vibe of it was that we have to write as though the whole world has gone crazy and people need our books to find out what happened, is what he said. You know, our books are going to be the record of what happened. And I think that's really important, and you can't spend too much time getting pissed off about where you're shelved or who reads you and who doesn't read you.
Yeah.
It's nothing you can do about that.
It's sort of like compartmentalizing yourself. The real sort of work is in actually writing the book versus, you know, this whole marketing aspect and where it actually gets distributed. This is kind of, I guess, moot to you?
Well, it's not moot. It's just it's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not important. And I don't say that I don't sometimes get myself into a complete frenzy about it. But I try to minimize it. And I also try to be really grateful for the readers I have who have been so nurturing to me. I don't know. I feel so lucky that I know that if I give a reading in certain places, that people will come and people say that the books have helped them. Someone once said to me about my first book, Leaving Atlanta, that my book gave her proof that she had not hallucinated her childhood. And I was like, for me, that's the point. That's the point. Screw Barnes & Noble, the shelving. Yeah. You know, that's the point, is that this woman felt better about her memory of her life because of my little book.
What could you tell me about The Bigamist's Daughter?
I like it. It's set in Atlanta. It's a novel about, I might change the title because you know there's that Alice McDermott book with almost the same.
Yeah.
But it's set in Atlanta. It's about two families that share a patriarch. And it's from the point of view, the first half, from the daughter who knows that her identity is secret. So it's like, not what is it to keep a secret, as in the untelling, what is it to be a secret? And about her, just this kind of outside looking in, also the class implications of it. I don't know, I'm really interested in it. I like the voice, a reminiscent narrator. I recently read a wonderful novel by Sigrid Nunez called The Last of Her Kind. Knock my socks off, great book. And just what she did with the first person inspired me to work on the point of view in my new novel.
So it seems to me that this notion of secrets and identity seems to be your major kind of theme, would you say? Or?
And place, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I'm always interested in the performance of self. How do we present ourselves? I mean, I think that's one thing that drives me nuts. Oftentimes I see on television, they're doing these cultural studies, and they interview the people, ask the people what they're thinking, and then they say they know who the people are because of what the people say they're thinking. And I think, no one tells you what they really think.
Yeah.
I don't even know how they can even get these little studies going, asking people, do you feel confident? Yes, I feel very confident.
So omniscient narration for you would probably be a really difficult thing to pull off, given that you're dealing with specifically identities here.
Omniscient narration, I don't like it. I don't enjoy reading it very much. I mean, I respect it and that there are people that do it, but I would never be interested in writing that. To me, the fun is, how can you tell the story from a particular point of view? How can you get the whole story in through one lens? That's the fun part.
Well, Tiari, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Champion.